Waiting can be so hard. Just think for a minute the last few times you had to wait. The last time you were at the doctor's office, or maybe the last time you were at the grocery store and you're in that line that just seems to not move while the two lines on each side of you just move. Or maybe while you're on hold with your phone company going from country to country, trying to finally get to the person. But of course, the waiting that can be even more difficult than all that is waiting on God. From our, I think if we would be truthful, we don't like to wait. There isn't a person in this room that likes to wait. Actually, from our toddler years, there's something inside of us that tells us to demand what we want. There's some voice inside our head that says, why should you wait? Scream for it. Fight for it. We want the desire satisfied immediately, and nothing else will do. Once a young mother came to Robert E. Lee, and she said, the general, and she said, what kind of advice would you give to a young mother? And she said, teach him to deny himself. Good advice. Waiting actually comes because we learn to wait, not because it comes naturally. There's nothing natural about waiting. Somebody has to help us understand the benefits of waiting. We begin a project and then we are overwhelmed with the laborious nature of the project, and so we throw in the towel. We pursue some kind of educational goals, and it seems as if it will never, ever end, and so we drop out midway. We begin a marriage obsessed with love. This was the most beautiful thing that could ever have happened, and then a few years later, we wonder what happened to the person we married. Where did they go? We no longer feel this beautiful, tingling sensation of love, and the marriage comes to an end. Waiting till a project is finished means you endure the hard, laborious work. Waiting until the feelings come back means you stick it out. So how does one actually learn to wait? Over 20 years ago in Stanford University, a famous psychologist there conducted an experiment. It's been imitated many times since. It's called a marshmallow experiment. And it actually, the name of the experiment is called delayed gratification. They actually took 5-year-olds. They set them in a room and they put a marshmallow in front of them. And they said to them, now I'm just going to step out of the room for a minute and you can eat the marshmallow if you want, but I'll be back in a couple minutes, and when I come back, if the marshmallow is still here and you haven't eaten it, then you get 2 marshmallows. Well, the films are still available to see those kids, the suffering they went through in the 2 minutes that the technician is outside. Some kids lick around the table around the marshmallow. Some of them go through all kinds of contortions, but about 90% of them eat the marshmallow. Only a small percentage still had the marshmallow and got 2. The interesting thing about the study is they followed those 5-year-olds for over 20 years through high school, the highest GPA, through college, the highest GPA. They didn't drop out. They didn't drop out of college. Marriages stayed together longer. They got better jobs. They stayed at the jobs better. Those same 10% that waited for the second marshmallow all the way for 20-something years because they learned how to delay gratification. They learned how to wait. Fancy word for waiting. Waiting is one of the most important subjects I could speak on, especially facing a brand new year. So it's my subject this morning. Let me introduce you to 5 scriptures. I could have given you 100, but 5 that have the word wait or waiting in it. Hebrews 9:28. He will appear a second time not to bear sin, but to bring salvation to those who are waiting for him. We wait for the Lord. Waiting is a part of the Christian life. Hebrews 6:15, so after waiting patiently, Abraham received what was promised. He is an example of a man who knew how to wait. And God commends him, puts him in the hallmark of faith. Hebrews chapter 12. Proverbs 8:34, blessed is the man who listens to me, watching daily at my doors, waiting at my doorway. I like the picture of that. Just waiting. I'm just waiting for the Lord. I'm just waiting at his doorway. Just want to catch a glimpse of him. Just waiting at his doorway. 27:14, wait for the Lord. This is Psalm. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and take heart and wait for the Lord. 37:7. And this Psalm is actually about fretting. Anybody had any of that happen in 2011? This would be a good Psalm for 2012. This is the prescription for fretting and worrying. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do you see that wait and patiently? It further describes waiting. Really, that's the only real way to wait, is patiently. Have you ever seen a person wait impatiently? Just take a look at a two-year-old. Well, take a look at some adults for that matter. Doesn't really matter, but some people wait, but they don't do it patiently. They get irritated. They get agitated. They get annoying. They're waiting, but they're not waiting patiently. So this one says, be still and wait patiently for him. Do not fret when men succeed in their ways, when they carry out their wicked schemes. It is hard to wait. It is difficult to wait. One of the things that happens when we cannot wait is we are attacked by an enemy called despair. This is the brutal enemy. He can creep on you in this process of waiting and cause you to despair or to throw away your hope. As long as you're waiting, you're hopeful. I'm talking about waiting for God now. I give secular examples here, but I'm talking about waiting for God. Whatever you're believing for, whatever you're hoping for. The enemy that comes to you is the enemy of despair to try to get you to give up hope. Viktor Frankl was a successful psychiatrist at the age of 26 living in Vienna, Austria, at the breakout of Hitler's attack on Austria when he annexed Austria to Germany. And Viktor Frankl had the opportunity had visa to come to the United States and live and escape the war, but it would only have covered he and his wife, not his mom and dad who lived with him, or his brothers, sisters. He couldn't bring himself to leave, so he stayed. He was arrested along with his wife, his parents, brothers, sisters. He eventually wound up in many different concentration camps. All of his family died, but he survived. By 1945, he had lost his parents and his wife to the horrible death camps. It was due to his and others' suffering in these camps that he came to his hallmark conclusion that even in the most absurd, painful, dehumanized situation, life has potential meaning. Now listen to this paragraph that he writes about the concentration camp. The prisoner who had lost faith in the future, his future, was doomed. With his loss of belief in the future, he also lost his spiritual hold. He let himself decline and became subject to mental and physical decay. Usually this happened quite suddenly in the form of a crisis, the symptoms of which were familiar to the experienced camp inmate. Usually it began with the prisoner refusing one morning to get dressed and wash or go out on the parade grounds. No entreaties, no blows, no threats had any effect. He just lay there, hardly moving. If this crisis was brought about by an illness, he refused to be taken to the sick bay or do anything to help himself. He simply gave up. There he remained, lying in his own excreta, and nothing bothered him anymore. It's despair. The teenager asks himself, is this all there is to life? I'm always struggling to be accepted. I feel I always have to prove myself to my friends. It's despair. College graduate hasn't been able to find a job. And so they say, why did I bother to spend all this money and have this $80,000 debt? I can't even get a job. It's despair. The young mother is overwhelmed with taking care of a baby and a couple of little toddlers and feels all alone, overwhelmed with despair. The disillusioned man or woman who is in the middle of a divorce often feels despair. Middle-aged man is disappointed with life. His business fails. He wonders if he made the right career choice, and he feels despair. Elderly gentleman lives life alone and wonders why life has to be so empty. He wishes his life could be over. It's despair. It attacks from the beginning of life to the end of life. It never, ever leaves us. We are vulnerable to despair. Our only vaccination, our only protection against despair is to develop this habit of waiting on God and hoping in God. Let me show you some scriptures that speak to despair. Isaiah chapter 40. Why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, my cause is disregarded by my God? Do you not know? Have you not heard? I like that. I like Isaiah's writing. You don't know? You haven't heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. Why is he saying this? Because this is what takes away despair. This is what changes your despair to hope. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope, that word means wait, same thing. Those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. Isaiah is actually articulating poisonous thoughts that the Israelites had. What makes the Bible so relevant is these same poisonous thoughts pass through our minds. Same way. But he's challenging, he's not trying to coddle the Israelites here. He's challenging them to not allow those thoughts to drive them to despair, but to drive those poisonous thoughts away with hope in God. I'm going to read you a portion of a letter. I love this letter. It's written from Martin Luther to his friend Philip Melanchthon. Philip Melanchthon also wrote letters like this to Martin Luther, but this just happens to be one from Martin Luther to Philip Melanchthon. And at this time, Philip was very much in despair. Listen to this letter. I pray for you very earnestly, and I am deeply pained that you keep sucking up cares like a leech, and thus rendering my prayers vain. Christ knows whether it comes from stupidity or the Spirit. But I, for my part, am not very much troubled about our cause. Indeed, I am more hopeful than I expected to be. God, who is able to raise the dead, is able to uphold his cause when it is falling, or to raise it up again when it has fallen, or to move it forward when it is standing. If we are not worthy instruments to accomplish his purpose, he will find others. If we are not strengthened by his promises, where in our world are the people to whom these promises apply? But more on this another time. After all my writing, this is like pouring water in the sea. That's called reverse psychology. That letter would actually encourage Philip. No, it's not pouring water in the sea. It's actually going to cause him to examine those poisonous thoughts in his head. Now, the first two verses I read to you, verses 27 and 28, I'm going to read them to you in the Message. Look at this. Why would you ever complain, O Jacob, or whine, Israel, saying, God has lost track of me? He doesn't care what happens to me. Don't you know anything? Haven't you been listening? God doesn't come and go. God lasts. You know what those verses say? You're important to God. That's pretty powerful, isn't it? I like what it says in verse 28. God doesn't come and go. God lasts. The use of the word Jacob directed as a name for all of Israel is not randomly applied here. Isaiah is actually using Jacob with precise meaning because Jacob is a man who suffered much despair, who had these poisonous thoughts go through his head many times. So the reader would immediately remember Jacob. He's a patriarch. We have to work at it more. But let me tell you about Jacob, because that's what Isaiah intends here for us to do, is to think a little bit about Jacob. Jacob, as Jacob means, was a deceiver. He tried to change himself over 2 decades, but he never was completely successful. His mother, his father were very, very faulted in so many ways, very dysfunctional, and Jacob carried every fault he got from his mother and father, and he lived up to his name as a deceiver. He was leaving where he had been living for 20 years. He was going back to the land of his fathers. The problem was he had to go back and meet his brother that he had so deceived and betrayed. And he's on his way back. His family's large. He's become wealthy. And he gets a message, the equivalent of FedEx back then, probably by camel. He gets this message that Esau is coming to meet you. Oh, yeah, and he's bringing 400 of his men. You talk about needing Maalocs and some kind of antacid for the next few weeks. Jacob is in turmoil. He is in despair. He did his brother so dirty. Twice he betrayed him. He was rotten, no good for nothing. In Spanish, we would say sin vergüenza. He didn't even have any shame about it. Now, God has been working on Jacob. He's coming back, but he has to face his brother. Before he can face his brother, he needs to be changed. And he experiences a life experiencing change, transformation, when he meets God the night before he meets his brother. Here is the biblical narrative, Genesis 32. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him. That man is an angel from God. We believe it actually is what we call theophany, an appearance of the Son of Man before Bethlehem. And a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he replied. Remember, Jacob means deceiver. How would you like to have a name that every time somebody saw you, "All right, Jacob." And especially if he lived up to his name. So the angel says here, or the Lord says to him, "That's not going to be your name any longer, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome." What a change. But the name was representative of the change that took place in Jacob. I'd like you to remember 2 things that Isaiah says in that passage I just read to you. 2 things. Just kind of mentally make a note here off to the side. Isaiah not only wants us to know how great God is in this passage I read to you, but he wants us to know how much we mean to God. That's what he's going to talk to us about in these following verses, how great God is. Number one, he wants you to know you mean everything to God. And number two, he wants you to know that God is so great. Those 2 things take your despair and cause it to vanish. Isaiah says, you mean everything to God. And secondly, God is great. He's greater than your despair. Look at verse 28. "Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God." That's eternal. The creator of the ends of the earth, he will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. There's four descriptions of his greatness in that verse. The first is a description of his eternity. God is everlasting. He's not wearing out tomorrow. Our perspective on things is usually exaggerated, out of focus, inaccurate. And we exhaust our energies on things that really don't matter because our perspective is so temporal. We panic when things don't fall into place. Our timetable isn't met. And from our perspective, it looks like a disaster. But from God's perspective, it's right on schedule because he is everlasting. What Isaiah would actually say to you this morning out of this passage, it's not what, it's who. It's not what. You could say, yeah, but you don't know my problem. And Isaiah would say, it doesn't matter. Yeah, but Isaiah, Isaiah would say, it doesn't matter. It's not what, it's who. That's the essential question for Isaiah here. It's not what events you're facing. It's who shapes the events of history. It's who's behind the history as we know it and who's ahead of the future that we believe in. It's God. He's everlasting. The little boy named Jared, the mom and dad had been very careful to teach him the phone number and address in case he ever got lost. One night, he and his dad went for a before-bedtime walk. After a few minutes of silence, Dan decided to test Jared's knowledge of where he lived. "How far are we from home?" Dan asked. Jared answered, "Dad, I don't know." Dan tried again. "Well, where are you?" Again, Jared answered, "I don't know." Then his dad said, good-naturedly, "Sounds to me like you're lost, son." With a confident grin, Jared looked up at his dad and reported, "Nope, I can't be. I'm with you." You're never lost if you're with God. You're never without hope if you're with God because he's everlasting. Second aspect in this verse is that God is the creator of the ends of the earth. And Isaiah says, have you not heard? Did you not know that? Have you forgotten that? I worked with a master carpenter for a few years in my early carpentry days. There wasn't a question I could ask that he didn't know the answer. Multiply that a trillion, million times. There isn't a issue that you can face. There is a problem that you come against that God doesn't know the way for you. Thirdly, God never grows weary. He will not grow tired or weary. It seems like we're all tired most of the time, some more than others. We grow faint, we grow exhausted, and we have to be restored. Whether through sleep or emotional restoration, we just need it because we feel like we're going to on the edge of collapse. But not God. He's inexhaustible. He's eternally inexhaustible. And his strength knows no end. His joy never ceases. His love and mercy are unfailing. God is always at work, even when we are asleep. Because he never grows weary. And fourthly, God's wisdom is unsearchable. My grandkids can get to the end of my wisdom. But God's wisdom is unsearchable. Do you not know that, he says? Have you not heard that his understanding no one can fathom? As difficult as life can be, as puzzling and enigmatic as situations present themselves, God is never baffled. He's never stumped. There's so much in life we don't know that God does for us. So much provision, so much protection, so much faithfulness. Hosea, his wife Gomer, was unfaithful to him, and she would have died had he not provided for her. But she was so clueless, she didn't even know he was doing it. Here she is, unfaithfully, giving herself to other men, and he's still providing for her. He would go and leave food in a certain place. She'd come and get it. She didn't even know. Hosea 2:8, she has not acknowledged that I was the one who gave her the grain, the new wine and oil, who lavished on her the silver and gold. But don't think Gomer's the only one. God does that for us for every day. His wisdom is so unsearchable. It's unfathomable for us. Isaiah says God gives power to the weak. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. He does that by renewing our strength. Look at verse 30. Even youths grow tired and weary and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. And then he gives us this word picture. All of us have seen the eagles at some point around here. And they look so beautiful when they're up there soaring in the sky. And this is the picture. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. Actually, your expectancy is what gives you strength. It renews you. Your faith, your hope brings physical, emotional, spiritual renewal. It can lift up those heavy arms and legs and lift the burden. There's no physical burden you've ever borne that compares with the anxiety and the heavy burdens that can crush the strength out of you. And he can lift them off of you. Waiting on God. It's the key. And I want to tell you, waiting is never wasting time. It's confident. It's disciplined. It's expectant. It's active. It's realizing there's no plan B. It's just waiting on God. It's really saying, you know what? I'm putting everything I've got. I'm not a betting man, but if I was betting, I'm betting everything on God. That's waiting. It's trust. It's God's timing. You know, the trapeze artists, there's a catcher and there's a flyer. So when you see one of those guys or gals go through the air, that's the flyer. The other one over there is the catcher. The flyer never tries to be caught because that's an accident. The flyer goes through the air, arms up there. My arms are there. I'm waiting to be caught. The catcher's up there. Catches them. So waiting is flying. But so many Christians go through the air like this. They want to be the catcher. They want to be the tosser. And God is in the catching business. He wants you to wait and just wait to be caught. But it's that lunge when you let go. He's like, anytime. Okay, God, go ahead. Anytime. And God's like, He's just waiting for you to get to the right spot. It's waiting. I looked up thoughts on three of my favorite writers. I'm going to close with the thoughts from Ravi Zacharias. I looked up to see what he had to say. I want to close with this thought. The other, I had two thoughts at once there. I didn't get confused. It may have looked like it, but I really didn't. I looked up three authors because I liked the way they write. One was Ravi Zacharias. The other one was Chesterton. And the third one was C.S. Lewis. You know Lewis would be in there. But I would like to encourage you this year to wait by enjoying simple pleasures. To learn to wait by enjoying simple pleasures. In fact, the simple pleasures will take you toward God. Complicated, illicit pleasures will take you away from God. So when you're having a cup of coffee early in the morning, enjoy the coffee. Enjoy the morning. Enjoy the time with your loved one. Enjoy the time with your Lord. So I want to just give you a few thoughts about pleasure. The dangers of pleasure and the strength of pleasure. Simple pleasures will help you wait. Illicit pleasures will always cause you to think you can't wait. I found I found three principles on pleasure that Ravi Zacharias had come up with. They're actually, he didn't come up with them. He just quantified them. They're actually out of the Bible. But he had the insight, and the Holy Spirit helped him to see them. I think they're very insightful. Here's the first principle. Anything that refreshes you without distracting you from your final goal is a legitimate pleasure. Anything that refreshes you. Remember Gideon when he had those men and God was telling him to take the size of his army down? And he says, go ahead and take a drink. And God says, every one of these men that laps water like a dog, they took the water like this. He says, you choose them. There's only 300 of them. All the rest, 9,700, send them away. Those men still remembered they were soldiers. They still remembered that they were on their way to fight a battle. They didn't get lost in refreshing themselves. So any pleasure that can refresh you without distracting you is a legitimate pleasure. Listen to this. Susanna Wesley once gave a definition of sin to her son John. It actually underscores what I just said. Son, whatever weakens your reasoning, impairs the tendencies of your conscience, obscures your sense of God, or takes away your relish for spiritual things. In short, if anything increases the authority and power of the flesh over the spirit, then that to you becomes sin, however good it is in itself. The second principle, any pleasure that jeopardizes the sacred right of another is an illegitimate pleasure. You remember David's men when he longed for a drink from Bethlehem, and three of his men went, risked their lives, brought him back this water, and David said, I can't drink it. I'm not worthy to drink it. My pleasure at the expense of your life would not be a good pleasure. Thirdly, any pleasure, however good, if not kept in balance, will distort reality and destroy appetite. Any pleasure not kept in balance will distort reality and destroy your appetite. Proverbs 25:16, if you find honey, eat just enough, too much of it, and you will vomit. Did you know that all pleasure has to be paid for by some kind of pain? A legitimate pleasure is purchased ahead of time. A young man or a young woman who wants to keep themselves for marriage and save themselves as virgins for marriage will go through the pain of going against a culture that demands they become like them. They'll say, no, I'm not going to do that. They'll have to say no to physical desire. Then when they marry that person they have saved themselves for, they enjoy a pleasure they paid for. The person who begins an illicit affair, so tempting, so wonderful, and the affair is pleasurable, but the price is paid afterwards. Illicit pleasures are paid afterwards. Legitimate pleasures are paid for in advance. But the simple pleasures are the ones that take you close to God and help you learn to wait for God. Let me close with this thought about C.S. Lewis and his book, Screwtape Letters. Screwtape Letters is simply a whole bunch of letters from a senior devil to a junior devil. The senior devil, his name is Screwtape, and he has a nephew named Wormwood. And Wormwood has been assigned to a young Christian man to try to draw him away from the enemy, God. At the end, toward the end of the book, Wormwood hasn't done a very good job because the guy is more of a Christian than at the beginning. And the uncle is trying to find out what he did wrong. He discovers, the little devil tells him, he said, well, this man would go for a walk every morning. He would just walk out through the parks and he'd look at the trees and the flowers and the birds and he'd come. He did it every morning. He said, well, what did he do in the evening? And the little devil would say, well, he read. He read his Bible. He read good books. He said, that's what you did. You're pretty much an idiot. You had a chance to mess this guy up and you let him alone. You actually let him enjoy some of life's simplest pleasures. When he was out there walking, you see what he saw? He saw the creation. He saw the creator. He saw the enemy. and he started enjoying his walk. You should have told him to walk for physical exercise. You should have told him he was fat, that he didn't look good, and that he needed to exercise more, and he would have started hating the walks. And then in the evening when he was reading those books and enjoying them, you should have told him, you need to get all this in your head so you can quote it to other people and be impressed by how much you know. He was just reading that and enjoying it and growing. The whole point that C.S. Lewis was making, when you take a pleasure, like taking a walk and enjoying it, it draws you to God. When you read a book for no other motive than to just nurture and rest, you get drawn to God. It's life's most simplest pleasures that bring us close to God. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, I pray that this year you would help every one of us, Lord, to enjoy the laughter of our spouse, of our children, our grandchildren. To enjoy life's most simplest pleasures and not get caught up in this anticipation of something great that has to come to our life. Something that has to be purchased. Something that has to be accomplished. Something that has to be achieved. Give us eyes to look around and see what is already right there in front of us, to enjoy it and to wait on you. To wait upon the one who is capable of turning every single thing in our life around, but in his time and in his way. I pray for the people sitting here today, Lord, that you will give them hope for despair. You'll give them perseverance in their waiting. And you'll help them to develop a simple life that draws them to you, that draws them to what is important in their life, so that they can be strengthened and renewed as that kind of hope renews us, Lord. We give you praise and we give you honor today as we commit our lives.